Okay, so I'm sitting here with Owen Edgerton, Austin's favorite author in 2007-2008, author of the Book of Heralds.
And 2010.
And 2010. I know. I was looking for that. I couldn't find it, but okay. Thank you for correcting me there. So Austin's favorite author, 2007-2008 and 2010. Author of the Book of Heralds, How Best to Avoid Dying. And also the Blacklist script, Bobby Sue, which is currently in production. Is that right?
It's not actually in production. In
development?
It's in development. Yeah.
Okay. Improviser, comedian, author, screenwriter, performer. So I am, and also in the background, you may have heard a few minutes ago, is his writing partner, one of his writing partners, Chris Moss. So, Owen, I'm going to start with a question that I think is going to be the first question on anyone's mind who's seen or read more than one of your pieces of work, which is, what's your obsession with Waffle Houses?
I do have a kind of obsession with Waffle Houses. I was actually talking to my dad about it recently because he asked the exact same question, like, what's the deal? I love Waffle Houses, and I think I do know a little bit why, but part of it is just going to have to remain a mystery. But part of it is just that you have these meeting places of such an eclectic crowd. You know, almost any Waffle House that you come to along any highway, and there's a lot of them in the South, and they kind of thin out the further west you get. But you've got this accidental family that appears there. They're the regulars who come in every day. They're the, you know, the folks who work behind the counter. The cooks are right there. There's no back room. You know, the cook is right there. And there's just kind of this bizarre crowd. There's the people who are just passing through, on their highway journey, and the people who have worked there for the last 15 years. And I love that sort of bizarre accidental family that takes place. I love the way those sort of individuals start affecting each other's lives, if only for, you know, a half hour. I've just gone into so many Waffle Houses while doing road trips, and at any time of the day, there's always something spectacularly interesting happening. Just recently, I drive back from New York. I stopped at this one Waffle House at 1 in the morning. And there was this large, bald, giant of a man laughing hysterically in kind of a frightening way. But the wait staff all knew his name. They're like, all right, calm down, Charlie. There's a guy behind the counter who was all excited because his first bit of money for being a National Guard had just come in. The old man who was the cook, when he was finished with his shift, he didn't leave. Came around the counter and sat in a booth with four other old guys, and they just started talking. It was obvious, like, this was a family that was happening here, and that just always intrigues me. Anytime you find families of a different kind of tradition, I'm fascinated.
So that's, I mean, looking at the Book of Heralds, that book is very much about a family that kind of comes together. It's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
These people that is from these different backgrounds that kind of accidentally come together to form this unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, is that one of the things, is that always something that's interested you? That's something that...
Yeah, I think the movement towards family is a sort of fascinating aspect of human nature, that we just naturally gravitate to wanting to have a family and then simultaneously try and push away from that same desire constantly. It's kind of part of the tension of what it means to be alive. So I find in my stories, they end up happening the same sort of way. One of my writing instructors, Deborah Monroe, had said that as humans, we want to often avoid conflict. But as writers, we need to make conflict happen. So take two people that you'd never wanted to be, you would never put in the same room, you'd never invite them to the same dinner party, and force them together and see what happens. I find when I do that in writing, eventually they form some kind of family, or they kill each other. But more often than not, they sort of form some kind of family, which of course just slowly kills each other. I think family is a theme I kind of keep returning to.
Mm-hmm. So another theme I've noticed in a lot of your work is a kind of what I would characterize as an affectionate irreverence toward Christianity or religion in general. Where did that come from?
Ooh, that would be a long one. I am a bit obsessed with religion. Again, I think religion, you know, I think humanity and individuals and as a culture, we're always sort of reaching for some sort of transcendent truth. And we reach with art, and we reach with myth, and we reach with religion. All of those can be wonderful and on occasion harmful. Religion perhaps being the sharpest example. I think religion has inspired some of the most beautiful accomplishments and kindest accomplishments of humanity, acts of charity and acts of art. But it's also inspired some of the most brutal attacks and cruel dogmas of human history. I'm fascinated with the power of that. It is this zone of humanity that wild, wonderful, crazy, cruel things happen. And that's true of my own life, too. My own sort of seeking of who is God, who am I, what does it mean to be alive, is there a moral responsibility, or is it all just meaningless? All these different things, I'm often finding myself going to the saints of the different traditions, and the poets and thinkers of the different traditions, and trying to find answers there. But I also find, at the same time, there's so much humor there. You know, there's this opportunity for humans to be ridiculous, and they do that within religion. So I have not yet landed, whatever search I am. So I think the next books I write will continue to be flavored in some way with that particular search.
And the other thing that. So, like, the other thing that shows up, I think, is very interesting. Probably my favorite piece from The Other Side of Sleep was, I think it was called Alligators, the one about the cult. The, you know, I'm going to put that word in quotes. You know, you did a very excellent job of, arguing the side against, you know, that's counter to conventional wisdom. You know, 95% of the population has a particular view of what it is to be in a cult.
Right.
And then there's this small segment that, you know, that has a different view. And you really captured that view very well.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think it's this experience that you have and this inquisition that you have towards religion that enables you to look at these kinds of things from that different point of view?
Well, you know, I think maybe so. I mean, Chris and I have often talked about this, and I find that the role of fiction is to expand the questions and to expand the mystery, not to pat ourselves on the back for our own opinions. And there's fiction out there that does that, that sort of says, gosh, you know, I think that was unjust as well. I'm so glad that I got to see this movie that made me feel good about my own opinions. Racism is bad. I agree with the hero of the movie. And I think that sometimes what we need more is something that troubles us and takes us to a place that we didn't necessarily expect to go and leaves us there with some questions. In the piece you're talking about, that's what I was kind of striving for. It actually was also similar, actually, while I was writing the Book of Harold. So the Book of Harold is, you know, of course, talking about the second coming of this fellow's claiming to be the second coming of Christ. And what I was amazed at was when I first started writing it, and I would share what I was writing with Christian friends of the Christian faith, they would automatically say, "Well, of course he's crazy, right? Of course he's nuts, because you know that's crazy." It was so quickly dismissed. There was a story, a historical figure in, I think in the 5th century, who was wandering around Central Europe, and, or I guess Western Europe, he was wandering what is now Western Europe, and he was singing praises, and he and his followers were performing healings in all these small towns, and he called himself Second Coming of Christ. And the church, as it was right then, was had expanded at that point, and they finally got to this one city where there was a bishop, a sitting bishop. And the bishop came out with his own forces, and everyone was wondering how this was going to end. The bishop knelt down in front of this man, this guy claiming to be the second coming of Christ, and then grabbed him by the feet, yanked him down, and according to reports, stabbed him to death. They took all his followers captive and tortured them until they confessed that all the healings were done by the power of Satan. So within just a few centuries, the Christian movement now declared, the Christian movement that was born out of a man who walked around, performed healings, and claimed to be the Son of God, now declared that anyone who walked around singing songs, performing healings, and claiming to be the Son of God must be inspired by Satan. It was a weird thing of how quickly the small fringe group, which was the initial pockets of the Christian movement, how quickly they became the leading group and dismissed the fringe groups. So in some ways that sort of inspired me of like, wait a second, you know, most religions that we kind of call, oh, that's a respectable religion, they were born as crazy movements. And I don't mean to be that as dismissive. I mean, most of the movements we respect and love, whether it's art movements or political movements, were born as crazy fringe movements, for everything from democracy to jazz music to, you know, beat poetry, whatever it is. And so it's so quickly for us to kind of go, oh, but, you know, Christianity or Judaism, whatever, or that's respectable now. It's only respectable because we've known it for so very long. It started out as a bunch of people, you know, worshiping alligators, you know, one way or another. So I think it's good for us to remind ourselves, you know, that we're all crazy, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So sex and the offensive in general.
Yeah.
You know, I noticed, so for example, in How Best to Avoid Dying, some of the more memorable stories for me were Lord Baxter Balsington, which is sort of a wet dream gone terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah.
And then there's of course the fecalist, and you know, so you see him a lot of your work is unapologetically raunchy and strikingly surreal and or absurd. Where does that treatment come from? What?
That's a great question. I just this morning read something on Goodreads. I don't know if it's always a good idea for a writer to go on Goodreads and read other people's reviews of his work, but someone had said, he said that occasionally I would go to shocking, he actually mentioned the Lord Baxter to Balsington story as like an example of where I fail, because like, oh, you think that's funny, but it's not, just offensive. And the truth is, I'm not trying to be offensive, or I'm not necessarily even trying to be shocking for the sake of being shocking, but I do find that there can be a place for that. My parents are doctors, and around the dinner table, some of the subjects that you weren't allowed to talk about at other tables were pretty typical dinner conversations, whether that's religion, sex, or politics.
What kind of doctors?
They're both family practitioners, but my mother was mainly a pediatrician. She mainly specialized in pediatrics. So there would often be conversations about, there was this stuff seeping out of this fella, it would look this color of the gravy, and my mother telling stories about pap smears gone wrong, and humorous anecdotes. I was like, wow, it was all sort of out there. And it wasn't sort of things as like, well, you know, body parts are things we shouldn't talk about. And sex is something, you know, it's kind of a bad thing. I sort of found, even in my own life, that there was sort of this puritanical view that even, you know, sex in whatever way was kind of naughty. You know, it was never not naughty. You know, even when we sort of have fun with the words, we like talk about it like, oh, sex is naughty. We enjoy it because of that. But it's sort of a weird, it's a weird thing. I don't think it's necessarily, it's not a very healthy way of thinking about sexuality. That being said, you know, just sort of that's part of it. I think for me, I'm kind of like, no, we should talk about sex, and we should be okay with that. But I'm also, I think, so that's part of it. But I'm also a fan of the humor and surprise. Monty Python, I've always been a huge fan of, and partly because they would go into a quiet room and make a loud noise, they'd make a pop, and they would talk about something like a phrase that you weren't meant to talk about, you know, and they would broach a subject to be unapologetically crude, but not just for the sake of being crude, but for the sake of finding the comedy and the absurd. So I think that's probably where that comes from.
Have you gotten a lot of backlash from that, either from like your wife or from from other people? You talked about this one person who's like, you know, he thinks he's being funny, but he's not.
Yeah, that was a Goodreads reviewer. Yeah. he just thinks that sometimes I go with that. I have not really. I've not had a backlash from anyone. I'm trying to think if I have. No, I've not really had a backlash from anyone, like anyone personally. But occasionally reviewers have said like some of the humor feels like shock for shock value, and that's been said, I think, at least one review, and that's probably the harshest I've gotten on that. I often, when I'm writing screenplays with Chris and Russell, one of the great things about Russell Sharman is the other writer we work with. And one of the great things about writing with them, we write for mainstream Hollywood, is that these guys will pull me back. So they're great at letting me kind of go overboard. They go, you know what, that's too crude or too disturbing of an image or whatever it is. I'm like, it is? So it's necessary for what we write to have a couple of friends who are able to kind of rein me in every now and then.
So let's talk about that writing process. So you've got two writing partners. What does it look like working on? I mean, actually, I'd like to take a little bit of a step back from
sure.
that. And first, like, so everyone's got a breaking in story.
Yeah.
How did you end up getting into the industry of being writer, author, performer?
Whew. Well, they're kind of all three different. They kind of bleed into each other. So I've been doing comedy in Austin since college. I started doing improv and a bit of stand-up when I was in college and kind of kept at it. And while I was writing my first novel, I used comedy gigs to pay the bills. And there wasn't many bills. I was living in a VW bus, so I kind of kept my bills to a minimum.
And when you say your first novel, you're talking about the Book of Harold, or you're talking about How Best?
No, actually, I had a novel before that called Marshall Hollinger's Driving.
Oh, okay.
And so while I was writing that novel, I was sort of living, I moved into a van and was working on that and doing comedy gigs and paying the bills. And then I started doing the signage show, the Alamo Draft House, and basically that was because my friend Jerm Pollitt had sort of been tagged for that job, and he wanted to pick a team, so he picked me and John Erler. And that paid very well, which was paid nicely. And I did that for many, many years. And when the three of us were having this sort of breakup, and Jerm and John were having some really serious arguments and legal confrontations, I sort of took myself away from the whole thing. And I was hanging out with my friend Russell Sharman, who lives in New York but does some research in Costa Rica, and my family and I were hanging out with him. And he's always written screenplays. He's a professor, but he always writes screenplays. So he would always read my fiction, I'd read his screenplays, and we've been doing that for years. And he'd written this one really funny screenplay called Henchman. I thought it was hilarious. And he had said, well, what are you going to be doing for comedy now that you're not necessarily going to be doing the show all the time? And I said, I don't know. I think it's going to have something to do with film. I just don't know what. He said, well, why don't you take a run of the script? I need someone to help me to make it funnier. So I started working on it with him, and he and I went back and forth, sort of revising the script. And then we showed it to our friend Chris. Now, Chris had been making movies here in Austin, like Chalk and Butcher's 15. And Chalk had gotten him some nice national attention. So we showed it to him, and he was excited. And he said, I want to show this to my agent, I want to show this to my manager. And I was wondering if... Can you close the door?
Yeah.
Close it.
Because it's not only... Sorry.
I said, you know, he said, I'm wondering if you would want some help. I'd love to work on it with you guys. And that's when the three of us started writing together. And we discovered quite nicely that we really worked well together. So that script kind of floated around, was with a producer. It's only recently, well, about a year ago, got optioned at MRC and now has a writer and a director, or I mean a director and a star attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going along really well. And we wrote another one pretty quickly after that. Then we wrote Bobby Sue, and Bobby Sue we took out into the market and were able to sell. And that's the one that got blacklisted.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been working ever since. Kind of steady, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all three going out to L.A. at the end of this month.
So all three of you are moving out there? And
all three of us are moving out there for about 8 months, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, so does Russell live in Austin now? Or,
nope.
You know, he's in New York as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, he's in New York.
Still. Cool. So where... Let me see. So tell me about the blacklist script, Bobby Sue. What, you know?
So it was our. It actually maybe would be a good example. So if you want to hear how we go about writing.
Yeah.
So every script is slightly different. But for our original ideas, for our specs that we take out to LA that we sell our own scripts, our process is usually that we'll brainstorm together about different thoughts we have on what's a great angle to move to stories. And then on our own, we come up with different stories. And we kind of pitch it to the other two guys. And we'll go back and forth and try and find one and chew on it for a little bit. But usually one kind of grabs us. So Russell had this idea about a female-driven comedy. Sort of, you know, taking some of the great comic actresses that are working today and making something that's worthy of their comedy. So that they're not just the other half of a romantic comedy, but it's centered on them, and they get to be hilarious. So with that idea, he came up with a sort of lawyer, female lawyer idea. We went with his idea and kind of built on it. We started, he kind of came up with a basic storyline, and we kind of changed that up, twisted it around, and made a beat sheet. So we come up with like all the different moments we think need to happen, the basic overall arc of the story. And then we do something called a closed-door draft. It means it's a draft just for our eyes only. We know we will not show this to anyone but ourselves. So one of us will take it for about 3 or 4 days and write as much as they can, let's say 20 pages. And then the next person gets it, like, let's say I get it next, and I don't change anything in those first 20 pages that were written. I start on page 21 and keep going. So we don't change anything of our own writing. We just power through until we have a finished draft. And then from that draft, we get back on the phone, we argue about everything, and then we start just sending it again in round robin, but now you can change everything and anything. And we basically go through the script a few times like that, changing, touching, improving each other's jokes, improving each other's lines, until eventually there's no one line that any one of us wrote. Instead, we've all had our hands on every bit of the script. And usually we can finish up a script when we're working steady and solid on it within 6 weeks.
So, you know, one of the things that's my experience as a professional editor is, you know, people get very attached to their own, you know, to their work. They're very attached to their writing.
Yeah.
And one of the lessons that I learned early on in my career and, you know, before I was doing it professionally was, you know, being careful about how you're changing something because
yeah.
people are attached to it. In screenwriting, that seems to be much more of a requirement to let go of whatever it is you've written because,
yeah.
you know, the next writer may change it or the actors are going to say whatever the heck they want to say anyway. And so, you know, so what, I mean, did you find it was difficult letting go, you know, coming from this background where, you know, you're the source of everything that you say, right?
Yeah.
Science show or improv or... you know, or writing novels, you know, to having to let go and give other people that.
Yeah, it is a difficult and strange process, and it's a different mental place from fiction writing as far as novels and short stories. In novels and short stories, I wouldn't ever want to collaborate, I don't think,
mm-hmm.
with someone. I want that to be mine. I mean, I love getting insight, and I love reading friends' work and having them read mine, but it's from me. working in comedy, whether in improv or Sinus of Pancake Show, there was always the need to collaborate. And always collaboration led to something better and grander than I could have come up with on my own. The analogy I used to use is it's like children playing blocks in kindergarten, and each of the kids is only given so many blocks. And they all want to build a tower, but each tower can only be, what, 7 blocks tall. But if the kids start working where one person puts down a block, and then another kid puts a block on top, and then a third kid puts a block on top, and they all three work together stacking each other's blocks, then you've got this huge tower. It's over 20 blocks tall. There's a tower that none of the kids could have built on their own. And that's what I found when it comes to comedy, whether it be improv or shows at the Alamo or working with Chris and Russell, is that we collaborate in such a way and we say yes and to each other's ideas in such a way. And we're loose enough with our own ideas that eventually a script comes out that there's no way I could have written on my own. We say to each other again and again how grateful we are for working together, because the projects that come our way, either assignments or rewriting or our own scripts, we just find that we need each other in a really wonderful way. So it's been great. It's been a true blessing.
Do you ever find coming from a background in improv, do you ever find that working in a scripted environment, things start to get a little bit more stale? Like the jokes are just a little bit like too calculated to really be funny?
Yeah.
Do you ever have that experience?
Yeah, there's definitely a little bit. There's also a weird danger that comes. I think he's mowing our yard too. I don't know why he's on our side. The timing is amazing. So there's definitely there's an interesting danger that happens. Oh, sorry. A different interesting danger that happens in screenwriting, where you've been working on a comedy script. Sometimes it can be a year and you're working on it, and there's some joke that's still funny. But you have to recognize it's funny because it doesn't seem funny anymore because you know it, and you're already aware of it. And that way, you just have to enter. You have to sort of have a craftsman's eye for comedy, as opposed to a connoisseur's eye, as opposed to like this tastes delicious. Where if you're no longer hungry and you've tasted it 100 times, it's more like I can taste it and recognize it has all the air properly, and that's the best I can go for now. And that happens. But I also found, you know, when I was writing my first novel, and I was doing some sketch and comedy and improv, that there was this...
He's coming back.
Is he?
He's kind of... That's all right. It'll be fine.
Okay. That there was this this weird temptation, this weird... Yeah, I guess a temptation would be the word. I was writing a novel, which I knew was years away from being done, and longer away from being in print. At the same time, I was writing sketches that I knew I could show my sketch group, Skinnies, is who I was working with at the time, show it to them on a Monday. We could rehearse it on a Wednesday and perform it on a Friday. And I was thinking, this is immediate gratification, and improv's even faster. But gosh, I've got to be careful, because I really want to do the novels, but I'm getting so much gratification immediately if I come up with something funny on stage. So balancing those out has always been a bit of a challenge.
So let's talk about it, because presumably, you know, a lot of the improv stuff, you know, I assume that you're not getting paid much for that, if at all, right?
Right. Every now and then, right?
I was doing some paying gigs
in the van days. So,
So, you know, but certainly, you know, these days as you're focusing more on your screenwriting, mm-hmm. I imagine The Other Side of Sleep, you know, that's something, it's, you know, 3 weekends, it's your own thing, indie thing.
Yes.
You know, it's not like the show that's on Broadway that, you know,
right.
that sort of thing.
Or the
right.
Or a huge moneymaker.
Yeah, exactly. So, is it difficult to balance the, like, to say, okay, you know, I need to take, how do you balance the time between this thing over here that you know is going to produce the revenue to pay the rent, to, you know, feed your family, versus these things over here that are really fun but aren't bringing any money in?
You know, to be perfectly honest, I don't think about it much. I I give the same amount of time. I've been lucky enough to continually do jobs I love doing and get paid to do them. My enjoyment of the job has had very little to do with the paycheck I've got on the other end. So yeah, luckily my wife handles all the bills, so she's aware of, she's more aware of what I get paid than I am. I mean, I can be kind of smart about it and everything, and but for me, the greater responsibility, my responsibility to a job is not dependent on the paycheck of the job. My responsibility to a job is what I promise to a team, what I promise to myself, or what I promise to an audience. So if I'm doing, for example, you know, a show at the Alamo Drafthouse or a show at Zach Scott, then I know people are paying to see that show. Not only that, but they're giving their time to see that show. So my responsibility is to give them something that's worthy of that time, to try and thrill them and entertain them, both. And I take that pretty seriously. It's wonderful that on the outside, every now and then a check arrives in my account. I love that. But in a way, mentally, I don't really connect the two. That makes any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't. It does, no, but it's... I mean, it's really great because, you know, one of the things, like... I heard John August say once that every writer's been broke at some point in his life.
Yeah.
Was that true for you, or have you always really been...
I'm living in a van. What
well, right.
Yes, that's probably pretty true, along with every writer I know. I've been pretty broke. Nothing too crazy. I've never gone without like food or anything like that. Writers can be a hungry lifestyle. And then you know it's a weird thing even now. Or actually, it's always been kind of a weird thing of writing's not necessarily a regular job, right? You don't have a 9-to-5, and you don't have a paycheck that's promised you at the end of every month. So we as a writing team, you know, screenwriting has paid me better than anything else, but it's as irregular as anything. Because we don't know when the next job's coming, and you don't know if you're going to get the next job. And I was really concentrating on that patch of grass right outside the window. I promise you he was going to be quiet, too. I can ask him to wait if you want. No, it's all right. All right. So you know, we don't know when our next job is coming from. So we just found out today, for example, that finally this money went through for a script we're writing for an animated movie, and we're super excited about that. That's exciting. But up until then, it might not have gone through. And, you know, we throw our hat into the ring for these other jobs, and maybe we get them, maybe we don't. I think... I have some friends who have said, well, I don't want to make the risk of going into being a full-time artist, whether that's as a performing artist or as a writing artist or whatever, because I need the security of a job. But if anything can be learned from the last few years of recession, it's those secure jobs are not secure, and that's a false security. So, I've always... sort of thought, go ahead and make the leap, and don't worry about being hungry for a while. If that's what it takes to get some writing done, then go for it.
You mentioned before that as a writer, you spend as much time talking to people on the phone and in meetings as you do writing. Would you say that your job is 50% sales?
Gosh, you know, I wouldn't have worded it that way, but perhaps so. I mean, in the screenwriting world, you are sort of constantly both selling your ideas and selling yourself, and that's an interesting place to be in. And then there's also there's the rewrites and there's the secondary meetings and there's you know responses and all that. But yeah, you might say that there's a whole lot of sales that goes on. There's a whole lot of just auditioning for jobs, which makes sense. I mean, once you get onto a writing project with producer and a studio, you're going to be spending a lot of time with those people in one way or another. And it's good that they like not just how you write, but they like how you listen to notes, how you brainstorm with them, how you respond to their brainstorming. So it makes a lot of sense that your personality plays into your job there.
A lot of people focus their energies in one particular area, and they'll target themselves into a niche. You've done a lot of stuff that kind of spreads out, runs the gamut. What do you think of the value of operating that way?
Right. That's a great question. I'm not sure if it's the wisest thing to do. So yeah, I have a bad habit of saying yes to most things that come my way. I'm trying to get better at that. But the advantage, I think, the advantage is the way these different genres of expression play off each other. So the playfulness that I've learned from doing improv comedy very much affects the way I approach the storyline of a novel or short story, and gives me a freedom to play in a narrative that I wouldn't have otherwise had, I don't think. Also, though, my understanding of novel story structure has really helped me when I go to the screenplay and think about a story structure in a real visual art form. So I'm kind of finding that they all bleed into each other and improve each other for the most part. It also, for me, just as an individual, it's fun that I can spend 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours in front of a computer all day, inside my head, and really be soaked up in some story that's taking place in a novel I'm writing. And then that night, get on the stage in front of the Alamo and dance around and look like an idiot. And I'm able to really satisfy both parts of my soul, the part that wants to be inside and wrestling and thoughtful, and the other side that just wants to be silly and jumping around and laughing with people. So getting to feed both those parts all in the same day makes me a very lucky man.
I'm going to step back a second. So you're married, you have a kid, don't you?
I have two. Yeah, two kids.
Two.
Yeah.
So how old are they?
My daughter is 5 and a half years old, and her name is Arden, A-R-D-E-N. And my son is 2 years old. His name is Oscar.
Was it a big, bold, scary move to go ahead and have those kids when you don't have the security, false sense of security, or no?
Hell yeah. both of them were surprises for both of us. And it definitely changed some of my decisions. And changed the root of some of my risks in some ways. I was doing sinus when we at the Alamo Draft House when we first found out we were pregnant with Arden, our youngest, and it made me incredibly grateful for that being, because that was my most secure job I've ever had. Made me very grateful for that job. Like, oh, this is going to make it possible for me to be a little less worried about some of the things, some of the financial things I otherwise would have been worried about. So, yeah, definitely changed the thing. But at the same time, in more recent years, as my wife and I discussed different risks and what she wants to do with her her career or, you know, what I'm going to do next or whatever, one of the things we are reminding ourselves of is that there's a greater gift to give our children than financial stability. There's an example of striving to live a full life. There is the adventure of taking steps and not knowing where your foot's going to land. And we hope that we are giving our children that as much as security and from a materialistic angle. You know. So in some ways, we're still mentally aware and intentionally going for the adventure and sometimes the risk.
Bounce ideas off of your Jody is your wife, right?
Yeah.
Do you bounce ideas off of her and talk to her about the opportunities and just kind of you know, does she help you come up with ideas for?
Yeah, Jody.
Become the fourth writing partner.
Yeah, Jody. You know, all our wives are really funny and fun people, but of course Jody's done professional comedy as well, and she's performed at the Alamo. And she's performed with Zach Scott, and she and I met doing improv together. So she has got a great ear for comedy. So yeah, I'm often running ideas or reading a section of a script to her, especially if I'm particularly proud of something. I'll read it out to her and, you know, let her know what the joke is.
So what I'm going to ask a little bit on craft. How do you distinguish the good from the bad? Because it's so subjective, right?
Yeah.
How do you tell when you're looking at that screenplay or reading that passage, oh yeah, that's a pretty good one?
You mean just overall writing?
Yeah.
Gosh, that's a great question. I think there's a couple of things that fall into it. One thing is, does the writer know what their sentence means? Just on a language basis of like, this is the actual meaning of a sentence, you know? And often I think with some younger writers, that gets lost. They think they've written something very pretty, but it doesn't mean anything, or it means something different than if they're accidentally saying something they don't mean to say. That's one thing, just as far as craft. I am a believer that sentences should be understood. They should be clear. I mean, Hemingway made poetry out of short, crisp sentences. He had a beautiful ability to do that. In my writing, I strive for that clarity as well. At the same time, on the other side of that is the ability for the language to possess mystery. And it's not mystery of meaning. It's mystery more in a larger sense of discovery. I'm a big believer, especially when it comes to prose, that a writer should be striving to discover something, and that there should be a sense of that energy within the writing. I'm not exactly sure how that comes through sentence to sentence. It's almost something I more feel. I seldomly will finish a novel if I feel that the writer knows what he's trying to tell me and is just trying to tell me something. He's figured something out about life and wants me to know, and he's come up with a cute story to let me know this, you know, his great lesson. I don't like that. It's more exciting when a writer is wondering, how does a son relate to a father? What does mortality mean to us as humans? Why is it so hard to stay in love? Whatever they're dealing with, but they are dealing with it, as opposed to trying to help me deal with it as a reader. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, for your do you read more literary fiction, or do you love, the suspense thriller, just the, you know?
I'm a sucker for literary fiction, but I think literary fiction writers can learn a lot from a suspense thriller writer.
All right. As a screenwriter, are there a lot of projects you've worked on for which you've received no credit and you can't tell anyone you've done it?
It's not that we can't tell anyone that we've done it, but, at this point in the game, you know, we've only been at it for about 2.5 years, and none of our scripts that we've worked on have made it to production. Any of the Hollywood scripts have made it to production. But there are a few of them that when they do, it's a good chance our name won't be on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the way the game works.
Mm-hmm.
It's the process of writing and rewriting and moving on to different projects is just how it works. I don't know if it's the best way to make movies. I kind of think it might not be, but it happens to be the way the system works. So, yeah, that will happen.
Let me look. What was the first play you were in?
In the alphabet the alphabet of Christmas in first grade, I played Santa Claus. It was a big role.
Did you have the beard then?
I did not have this beard. I had a beard. I had a Santa Claus outfit too. I loved it.
What are some of the other just kind of memorable shows that you've had along the way? Some of your more memorable moments.
Let's see, memorable moments. In high school, we did Showboat, which was really fun. I got to be Captain Handy, and I really enjoyed playing that role. But I do remember that some of my friends, because we didn't go to a very ethnically diverse school, they decided to put some of my friends in blackface to play the slaves, and that was amazing. That's really disappointing. I got to do about 5 years ago. We did a sign-a show called Travolta-thon, which had clips of John Travolta movie, television shows, all through his career. And in the sketch, we all three of us played Travolta at different roles in his life. And I got to play him as Boy in the Bubble when he was a pretty young teenager. And that, it's funny enough, that is one of my more favorite things I've ever done on stage.
Right.
And then I also got to play, Pretty in Pink. I'm trying to remember the actor's name. Have you seen Pretty in Pink? It's the bad guy in Pretty in Pink. Anyway, I never gotten to be such an asshole on stage, but I got to be an asshole on Smoke on stage, and I really liked being an asshole, it turned out. That was super fun.
That was some of the... So you have a perpetual smile, and you always seem to be in a great mood every time I've seen you, at least.
Oh, yeah.
Are you known for your perky, optimistic attitude, or what do you look like when you're complaining?
I think I'm known for being pretty optimistic. That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
Elfish, as people have put it. Elfish.
Okay.
When I'm in a darker mood, what I do is I get pretty quiet. And that's when I'm writing, when I'm writing alone. It's funny enough, I'm pretty cheerful, but I don't know if I'd actually call myself an optimist. I don't really have, I'm pretty disappointed in a lot of the world around me, and I see life as being a really dark, dark experience. But with all that, I guess maybe you'd describe me as a pessimist with hope. Probably the way to do it. That's why I smile.